It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking in a way about the ways that art can challenge our viewpoints, our attitudes. We may not even have known we have these attitudes. And our guest uses artwork to provoke you into examining what you're seeing in nature. And so when we make art from nature, we can represent natural elements, but we can also assign different meanings to the objects, and we can take some freedoms in our expression of that. And with me today for the conversation is Megan Jefferson, who is a painter, a muralist, a watercolorist, an educator, all around great, a visual artist. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So let's kind of dive in. Were you trained originally as a painter or an artist, or how did you get into doing this?
Yeah, I went to school at Miami University, and I have my bachelor's of fine arts degree from there. You know, when I was growing up, I always loved making art and creating, but I never really thought about pursuing art as a career. I really always thought that I would be a doctor. School was something that came easily for me. I was good at memorization, so taking tests weren't necessarily a problem. And I actually liked academics, and I liked excelling in it. So it was a path that was a natural one for me to consider. And I always just had in my mind that I would go to medical school. And then when I was in high school, my family moved to a suburb outside of Cleveland, and I had grown up in a small town that was a few hours away. So it really kind of changed things up. And one of the best things for me during that transition period was creating art in the art classes at the new high school. I just got lost in it. It was therapeutic. It was comforting. It was something that I really found a lot of peace with. And so I was being pulled towards creating more and more, but I had this struggle because I had always in my mind thought that I would follow this different path. And then when I was at freshman orientation, I was sitting there. I had gotten accepted as a pre-med major, and my mom and I were sitting in this large auditorium, and the presenter was talking about all the organic chemistry and chemistry courses and science courses that I was going to have to take. And I just felt this overwhelming knowing that it was not at all what I wanted to be spending my time doing. I never really liked chemistry classes and those kinds of things. I could get through them, but I didn't find them very interesting. And once the fire started burning in me that connected me to my creative spirit, I just knew that that is exactly what I wanted to keep following. So I turned to my mom and I said, "I really don't want to be here." And she said, "What do you mean you don't want to be here?" And I said, I don't want to be a pre-med major. I want to be an art major. And so she said, "Well, let's go then. Let's go." And so we stood up in the middle of the presentation and walked through a hall of about 200 people and went to the exit, found the art building, found somebody to talk with there. And I immediately changed my major and started on the path of finishing with a degree in art.
Wow. And was it your degree generally all kinds of forms of art? Did you stay predominantly with the visual arts when you were doing that?
So you did have to pick a focus at the university.
Oh, good.
I did. And you didn't have to do that until about your junior year, so midway through. So I got to experience a lot of different art forms. I took a lot of jewelry making and metal making courses. I really loved that. And ceramics, sculpture. So we got a taste of everything. I think for me, the biggest draw with painting was that it was so immediate. And you could really get close to the artwork in that you could use your hands and make marks by smudging them with your fingertips. I found that when I was in the metal jewelry making classes, which I also really loved, I would always try to touch things and I would want to bend and manipulate the metal. And of course you have to use tools for that. Not only is it hot, but it's hard to manipulate. And so just being so tactile, I found that painting gave me the end result that I wanted. And then also the creative process was important to me. So I chose to follow that.
So chose to go down a path and your mom was supportive.
Yeah.
And I know your mom and I know how supportive she could be. And as you go down that path, there had to be in your head, okay, how am I going to do this of once I graduate financially, right?
Yeah.
I think every artist that I know of has to go, right? That day of reckoning comes. Okay.
Yes.
So yeah, I'm out of school now. Now what? Well, where did that journey take you then?
So while I was at Miami, I did get some jobs with the art museum. So I worked under the registrar and had some administrative positions that were within the art world without actually creating work. And I did that so I could have the experience of having something within the field, not necessarily, of course, making art, but something that I knew I could apply to with that experience. So when I was out of school, my first job was at a historical museum and it was doing a lot of administrative work. And then after that, I realized, you know, I wanted to be doing something in the contemporary art world. The historical museum was interesting, but it definitely wasn't as, it didn't light the fire that I was used to having. And I think that when we become so attached to that creative energy, it's, you know, what's missing when there is something missing. And so I started to look for other opportunities and I found an organization. And at the time I was living in Cincinnati because my husband also went to Miami University. He was also an art major there. So he was an art education and ceramics major. And he had gotten into grad school at the University of Cincinnati, which is why we were living there. And I found this organization called Artworks, and it was a nonprofit and with an aim to provide job training to youth through the arts. And I met the executive director. They were working on a giant public art project and they really needed all hands on deck. And so I was able to hop over there and get a job with them. I quickly became the assistant director because they just recognized that I really was interested in what they were doing. And then I led the program for that summer. So I oversaw 60 artists and 6 public art projects, partnering with different nonprofit arts organizations within the city to come up with these meaningful work experiences for youth. And then we had 230 17 through 19 year olds who worked on all of the different projects. And we did things like rehabbed a bus stop and created a beautiful mosaic on the ground and painted the whole interior. We drained an entire fountain, which is the biggest in Cincinnati. And I think it encompasses an acre or two, and painted a giant mural on the bottom of that fountain. And so all of these different public art projects were really impactful. And I saw the impact of murals and how they could just shape a space, change a community, and have a really positive impact. So I knew that I loved working with all kinds of people and bringing them into a space where they could have a creative outlet.
So this kind of scale you're talking about, I mean, an acre, and even any murals, you know, wall murals, I'm thinking of on buildings, you know, people don't have any idea about scale. And so I assume you work from, do you work from a sketch or and that kind of thing? And then how do you scale it up on something that big?
With that, it's a little difficult because it's on the ground. So yeah, there's a way to project something from far away. And at that time, there weren't anything like drones or anything that we have now. So we had to simplify things and just create basic shapes.
Okay.
But the same thing kind of goes for murals. They're most effective when they can also relate to the space in a way that the scale makes sense. And so for some of my murals that I create now, I do project images, and some I just freestyle, which basically means I have the idea of what I'm going to do. I've had the experience to know what scale is going to work. And then I create the piece standing back a lot, coming towards it. Because when you're working 12 inches away from a wall, it's really hard to get proportion right.
Yeah.
And so depending on what it is that I'm making, if the proportion is something that's really going to affect the overall composition and image, then I will project it and kind of trace it out beforehand. But because I've been working with florals and plants and drawing and painting those so much, at this point, I don't even have to really map anything out. I can just create it on the spot.
It just seems it seems really amazing to me. So here, I'm imagining that you have to get up on a lift sometimes.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And you're looking at the scale. Excuse me. You're looking straight down at, I mean, straight across at it.
Yeah.
But the rest of it's down below you, or it's above you, and
right,
or to the side of you. And so you said just stepping away. So you got to lower yourself down. Then you got to go. But you somehow, I would think, and I've seen some of your work, you have to capture it from the viewpoint, right, where the eyes are of that person looking up, or otherwise it looks really distorted, right? So
it's exactly,
so you're actually distorting the image so that it, in a way that makes it look right from the ground. Am I right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Oh my gosh.
So you're talking up and down ladders, walking back 30 feet, checking out the entire wall, making sure that everything does look scaled and correct, and then also drawing with my whole body. So when you think about just drawing on a small piece of paper in front of you or on an easel, you're not really moving much more than your arm or your wrist. But when I'm creating at that scale, I'm using my entire arm. So often my flowers are about that size because I can reach that far. And that's a really comfortable scale for me to work in. And I've got pretty proficient at it because I've been doing it for a long time.
That, that kind of whole way that your brain has to translate that. And it's not purely mathematical. I mean, it is mathematical in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So now we go back to, yeah, you had all that stuff before. You're mixing colors too. So you're doing chemistry kinds of things. You're doing all that. So all of those things that you didn't want to do as a profession are still coming to play, right?
True. Yeah.
And absolutely. So that's amazing that that's all in one individual to do that. And I don't think our listeners sometimes have an idea of what a muralist who does a really good job of a mural goes through to do that. You know, if it's meant to be looked at way far away from the interstate or like on a billboard, that's a different thing. But mm-hmm. when you're talking about walking along down on a trail or down below, in a street, even maybe in very narrow alley, and you're looking up, it's going to be very different what the artist has to do. And you've got that. So what was the path then that led you to loving nature so much? And I know you love things about herbs and learning about plants. And so talk to me about how did you go from there I know they were incorporated in it, but what got you going on all that whole world?
You know, I think that it's always something that I've been curious about and had an interest in. And being able to trust myself enough to follow the thread of curiosity is something that art has taught me as well. You know, saying no to a life of formal science within the medical field and choosing one of creation was something that took courage. It took being able to really listen to an inner voice and a curiosity, and then saying yes to that. And I think that that connected me to all of those strings of curiosity that have always been there. A connection with nature and being outside, the renewal that it provides, and a natural curiosity about everything and just how it works has always been a big part of who I am. And so I think that being outside and experiencing the, you know, the peace that can come with that and following the curiosity was what just led me to combine the two. And I've always had such support in following whatever threads I'm interested in following. So especially with what I create. So as a painter, when I first started painting, I was really into creating abstract pieces. So they were mostly about color, abstracting different shapes or different portraits. And then I really got curious about landscapes. And I think for me, there was a connection of the groundedness of the horizon line. So if you look at a lot of my paintings, you'll see that there's always a horizon line. And it's a very grounding feature in all of my work. And then mostly there's color. And it might be an actual depiction of a place, or it might be abstracted. And it's interesting to follow the path that I've taken, because there's always elements from previous work that slowly morph into whatever it is that I'm doing now. So after landscapes, I got really interested in florals. I had two kids, and we spent a lot of their childhood outside. It's just a great place for kids to be. And, you know, they were also really just renewed by being outside. So I responded to what was around us and just kept exploring and pushing how to create things on canvas that would also bring other people a sense of groundedness and peace and joy. And really, that's what all of my work is about.
Yeah, so you're talking about another dynamic, and I think that's wonderful. I describe you, because we collaborate sometimes on you teaching watercolor classes, but I always talk about you as a Zen artist, meaning that the calming, the way your whole presence of the way you do teaching. But that seems to come through in a couple of ways in what you just said. One is you kept saying, and I think that's important for people to hear, and that is, you have to, there's an inner drive, an inner passion, an inner voice that just feels right. And maybe I would describe it as flow, that you're in the flow of something. And if you answer the call to that, which sounds like you have, you find great peace and great pleasure in that, that transcends other things. And it just seems like you make your way, even financially or with family or whatever, it seems like it works. Is that part of what you're feeling when you're doing
it? Yeah, absolutely. I feel really fortunate to always have been supported in whatever it was that I wanted to explore in terms of paintings, and then being able to sell those or market in a way. I have had longtime supporters. So I've been here in Indianapolis making and selling work for 20 years, and often, you know, have the same art fair circuit every summer and see repeat clients. And no matter what the imagery is, there is still a sense of acceptance and support that I get from a lot of times repeat buyers. I think that most people would say that there is a sense of poetic peace that comes across in my work. I think that the color is really important and good at translating mood. And so I create to feel good. I create because I can't ignore the feeling to not create. And I create so that other people can experience the same kinds of feelings, hopefully, from the work. So,
and that's apparent. That is apparent in what you do. So, you know, I get a sense of that two-way street. So, most artists don't create for themselves alone. They can, you know, there are some recluses in the world, and they don't care if anybody else sees their work. Mm-hmm. However, it's a feedback loop that's different for you than sometimes I think. It's not as mercenary. What you're talking about is there's this joy that comes through in what you do, and there's a joy that comes back from somebody who appreciates it. And so it's less of a financial transaction, although there is part of that because we're in a capitalistic society. But I get what you're saying. There's this mutualism in there.
Absolutely. And there's nothing better than being able to get that feedback. And before social media, it was really I was really only able to get that at places where I was exhibiting, at places where I might be showing that weekend at an art fair. And it's always really helpful feedback to receive, especially crowdsourcing that information. And now on social media, it happens even faster. So you really get a sense of what pieces are effective in relaying that, those feelings of intention. So it's a really, I think for me, that feedback loop, it helps provide some sort of path that I connect to people and understand that my work was effective.
By it's not just by the reaction, but by more than that. So there's more happening there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's body language, there's many, many things that are going on, but there's also something that I think almost without getting spiritual or something, but almost transcends this kind of between the two minds. So when somebody, and it's true to art, I think, when somebody buys a work, a piece, whether it's a sculpture or whatever it is, if they're not just acquiring it for a collection, or they're not just trying to do, they do have some sort of connection to the piece, but to the artist through the piece, which I think is just pretty amazing, that you get that relationship and you can get it back. I know you do, particularly from the artist back through the person that buys your painting. And so you have this kind of mutuality that you're interested in them. And it's that art that did that bridge.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
So I can see, I see this, you know, when you think about it, you know, that's why art therapy is so important. Music therapy, any of those, yeah. Because sometimes we don't have the words with mm-hmm. which to say something. And so artists are really good, just like poets, about cutting through to the essence of what something is. And so one of the things I love in your work that I notice is, and it isn't quite like Bob Ross, where it's happy little mistakes. However, I do think that you see mistakes as opportunities, because sometimes you're on something big, or you've got paint, and paint is always fickle. You know, and the surface that it can be on, it can react differently. And you turn those, I've watched you do that. You turn those things into things that you may not be really seeing, you know, so you're not accurately trying to represent like a piece of, you know, the flower arrangement, but you flow with whatever's happening on the canvas. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think that the creative process has shown me that nothing has to be too defined. You know, there's a freedom when you can let go and let the creative process guide whatever is happening on the page. So I often do reference certain places, or I work from outside, but then I also let this dance and this conversation happen between me and the canvas, or me and the paper, whatever it is I'm working on. And sometimes a color will just be beside another color that is so excellent that you don't plan for. And you, for me, I love the ability to respond to that in a way that says, oh, let's let that be. You know, it's the painting says something, and I am quiet enough to be aware that there's an opportunity there. So I think sometimes when an artist sketches something out and has this idea of what it has to be or what it has to represent, for me, that feels a little too claustrophobic. I like to have the opportunity for a lot of change and for a lot of development, for a lot of spontaneity in the work. And I feel like it feels more like a creative flow between whatever is being creative and my choices.
Yeah, no, I think that's a part of it. I mean, I think people don't understand. I was in an exhibit designer in the museum field. And when we would design things, we would think through exactly what you're saying from a creative viewpoint. So it was that we had to be allowed to be able to flow through these thoughts and ideas as silly as they might be and try to represent them. In the end, yes, people gave us some response from administration or others in that process, and that modified some of what we were doing. But if you didn't allow us to do that freedom, mm-hmm. of if we were, to lack of a better word, if we were just a hack for somebody, in other words, just draw this, paint this, we could do that, but it didn't give quite the pleasure. And we found it didn't give the pleasure to the visitor at all. And so I think that's amazing.
I agree 100%. And what I have found when I talk to people who are viewing my work is if I had that really dramatic experience of flow when creating the piece, the viewer is drawn to it. Yeah. And if there was a struggle or if there was something that was a little too confining about the piece when I was making it, or I never kind of got to push past and get into that space of flow, then it's just not as effective. And so many people, whether they know anything about the formalities of art, are able to talk about specifics in an artwork with any kind of background knowledge or not, they get that and they feel that. And I've never been able to describe it to understand what it is, but it's a knowing that we all have and we can feel it and see it.
Yeah. And, you know, it comes through. It really comes through. I've been thinking about this lately. It comes through in culinary arts. Mm-hmm. You know, when a chef connects with something and you're the one and you have that meal, you know, you had something. It isn't because they're a famous chef or whatever. It's just something that, you know, wow, that is the flavor. I can't even tell you why. It's the same way in drinking wine. Some people get all into the technical aspects and using all the words and all that. But there is something about a really good wine, and it doesn't matter about cost. You just know it and you feel it because the winemakers put part of their soul into it, and you're getting that soul through that. So I think all the arts, all those art forms are exactly what you're talking about. I've been talking with our guest, Megan Jefferson, really about her journey and experience to get to where she is today as a muralist and artist, and to be able to get into her flow. We're going to have more conversations after a short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest, Megan Jefferson, really about what we were ending with was this idea of flow and a connection to the person that has your work, how arts can move back and forth. And Megan, it provoked me to think about a question that was, do you paint for yourself? Do you paint for somebody else? Or how does that happen? You know, if you like it, do you have to feel like you have to modify it? I mean, how does that process work in your own brain?
Well, I think there's a couple different scenarios. So I paint for myself because there's no way I think that I couldn't. It's such a driving desire that to deny myself the ability to create just doesn't feel right. So a lot of times I will just paint for myself, and I really look forward to the times where I can just explore and have that dance in the studio where it's just me and my work and it isn't for anybody else. And then there's times when I have a commission and the client really wants XYZ included in the painting. And I think that, you know, that is painting for an audience, that is painting for somebody. The hard part is keeping the magic in the painting if you feel like you have to end up with a certain result. So I always try to hit a midpoint where I share the piece that I'm creating with the client, if it is a commission, and then I allow for their input. So at least I can have a little feedback at that point that might pivot the painting in a direction that they would like to see it go. And I try not to look at those suggestions from them as anything that would stifle the work, but more of an opportunity to explore something that I didn't maybe see. And then if I feel like it's too much of a diversion, then I'll explain that to the client too. Like, this is where I'm headed with this, and I don't want to actually do that quite yet. And so, you know, having a personal relationship with the person that you're creating for is really important so that they can feel like they're being heard if it's something that they really want, and that they also understand that part of the magic is that creative process and letting the end result be a visual representation of that.
That's a really great answer. And you know, sometimes you have a set of variables that you're given. Mm-hmm. And it could even be just the space. You know, there's a set of restrictions just on what you have to paint on, like you were saying. The big fountain area, there's just some restrictions as to how you could do that because of seeing it all. It has to flow differently. And I remember years ago in the Children's Museum when I worked there, we were designing an exhibit around some really odd pieces that we had in the collection that were loved, but we didn't know what would hold them together. And so it ended up being a gallery called the What If Gallery. And so then they just stood on their own within there, but it held together under the idea of what if, but we put these really weird things, like a submarine that somebody had built that kids could crawl through. But what was it? We didn't want to do a whole underwater exhibit. If that makes any sense. So
yeah,
stuck them in there. And probably your kids, even when they were little, may have seen those. And it's just what you were talking about. It's still, though, we take those and artists can work within the constraints of certain things, as long as they still can be creative within that and find that path. So if exactly. I want a Winnie the Pooh mural that looks exactly like out of the book, that's probably not a fair thing to ask an artist to do. You could, I mean, and you pay them enough, they'll do it. However, mm-hmm. it's not the same thing as I want some Winnie the Pooh characters or Winnie the Pooh-like characters, because today we can't actually paint them without paying the royalty to Disney. But there is this, you know, thing where we that's where that moderation between the client and the artist has to come in. No, I'm not going to just paint that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of it's education too, because not everyone understands what it looks like to be an artist or have a creative practice. And I see every single project that I'm working on as a creative endeavor in problem solving. And so, because I have such a wide variety of things that I do, it takes a very fluid, flexible, creative approach to every single project. So some, you know, there's mural spaces that you can maybe only see from a certain angle. And I really like to always visit the spaces where I'm going to be creating the work for, and then respond to what else is shaping that space. So what other colors are coming into play here? What angles are blocked? What's the message that we have? What are the must-haves in this piece? Where are the spaces that I can bring some spontaneity too. And also commissions. So I do a lot of oil painting commissions, and I often visit the home and I see, I get a sense of their style, and I want to make the piece work within the space itself. It's always so important to me to do that.
Yeah. And so you are, you know, I think when I taught art to, I was trained as an art teacher as well as elementary. And when I taught art to children, it was, often the worst thing you could do is give them a blank paper and just say, do whatever you want. Sometimes we really do need to have some prompts before we eventually, like you begin to learn those, to see those prompts in nature or wherever you're looking. But when you're first learning, that's kind of the worst thing. Like, it causes this brain freeze, and some kids, yeah, they got what they want to do, but a lot of them don't. That brings up a really important connection then. So I always like to describe, because I do teach in the biology department at Butler, I always like to describe the way nature is as being whimsical. And it's like there are things in nature that don't make any sense, right? I mean, we can analyze some things and say, oh, well, we can explain why, or we can say there was some force driving it to do this. But then there's just things that completely make no sense at all. And all I can put it on is whimsy and play, that nature must be playing around with something. And so I would assume that when you're out there, you're the same. You start seeing these strange oddities of nature, where something, like, we all look for a four-leaf clover, right? Because it's an oddity. There are just some things. So do you sense that playfulness, that whimsy? Does it come through then in your art?
What I sense most is a magic and mystery.
Okay.
I think that that there are just sometimes no answers, or, you know, nobody has defined what exactly it is. But we can all agree that life is full of mystery that no one can explain. And that space is a space that I really enjoy, and I think is a connector that everyone, no matter if, you know, they focus on a specific set of rules for their life, whether it be religion, spirituality, or, you know, a moral set of standards, we all are here together right now on this spinning rock. And nobody can really explain everything. And so when I'm in nature, there's a sense of wonder and awe, and also a connectedness to everything and everyone. And that's the main feeling that I would describe that I try to translate in my work as well.
Yeah, and everything really in nature is also, and I can see it in your work, it comes through as, it's almost always a blurring. There's almost no hard edges. There's almost no right angles. It's really different than the human built world, which has its own beauty because, you know, it's geometric and that kind of thing. But nature is this kind of even flowing of color. And, you know, it's amazing, I think, even though we know that maybe on a plant, the flower does a certain coloration to draw the pollinator down into where the nectar is, almost like runways. But those runways are more than runways. They're just the way they play out and the fringes. And I would assume, and I see that in all of your work, even if you're not representing it by just drawing straight from it. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it's influencing your drawing of plants and flowers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, sometimes I'm drawn to create things, which then I read a bit of something and something else that I'm interested in, or listening to a podcast that I can then apply and say, wow, yeah, that makes sense in nature. And that also makes sense when viewing my work. Like, an example of this that I can think of recently is, I'm interested in creating these pieces that have a depth of field. So there's a sense of space where everything in the background is really blurry and soft, and then things that are closer in the foreground are more defined and have harder, crisper edges. And I know from listening to a few podcasts about in the field of neuroscience, that when you allow your eyes to rest and incorporate more of an outside perspective, that your parasympathetic nervous system is able to create actual physiological changes in your body. So your breathing slows down, your heart rate goes down. And I find that fascinating. And I think it's also true that it can, that creating an artwork that has that same effect can have that effect on the viewer. And so I've been playing around with that. And I have asked people staring at these pieces, how do you feel? What does it make you feel? And the overwhelming response is calm. So again, that mystery that we can explain and maybe not completely understand. It's amazing to me that we can recreate these things from nature and have a similar effect.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, that is why people have murals in their house. That's why they have certain paintings. Some of it is just to match the decor, and that's fine. But a lot of times it's got more meaning than that. And when you find one of those kinds of paintings, it becomes really, really interesting. And I like the idea that it's a dance with nature that you're doing, which means that you got to do just a lot of sitting and observing too, not always working in a sketch pad, not always doing that part, but just being present and allowing, because sometimes you have to wait before you see things,
yeah,
or hear things. And so I think that's a really wonderful thing. And we really are, isn't it funny that it takes the Japanese to teach us that we are coming to find that for the forest bathing and those things are important for our mental health, mm-hmm. where we just do what you're saying. Wow. When I also think about your art, you're self-taught in several places, but one of them I know that you're self-taught in is watercolor. And so you do this incredible new work, and even it goes on to fabrics and clothing. And so what led you to take up watercolor after all of the, I'm sure you were working with acrylics and other things before, but now how did you get over to watercolor?
Yeah, that, you know, it just happened a couple of years ago. I had always feared working with watercolor because everything I had created with it was never, I was never happy with the outcome. There's a certain aspect of watercolor that takes a lot of planning if you're going to approach it in a traditional sense. So you have to start with your light colors and then build upon those and leave the light areas because you can never go back, right? They can only get darker. And that was a challenge for me. They always felt a bit forced and they never had a sense of looseness that I appreciate in my work. So it just so happened that one day I picked up some watercolor and some paper, and it was a cold winter day. And I didn't feel like bundling up and going to my studio. And at the time I had an outdoor studio where I had to make a fire and get the garage nice and warm before I could create out there. And so I just started a fire inside and decided to work with materials that were really mobile and easy to work with. And that was watercolor. And I found that when I released myself from having to work within a traditional approach and just let the watercolor be itself and show its true essence. And by that, I mean, water runs, it drips, it pools, the colors blend. And when you allow those characteristics to happen, they are beautiful. And I felt like it was a dance that was working and it didn't feel forced and it felt very calming to me. And I found that I could just paint and paint and paint and paint. And then the end result was so beautiful because it just was able to show off all of the, you know, the beauty of the material itself. And so I just kept going. And it was, again, just kind of one of those threads of curiosity that I decided to follow. And the end result was one that I'm happy with. And it's just the process is so calm and peaceful that I will do it any chance I get.
It's so great because it, and you're right, because I use watercolor as well. And it is, when you do it, it's daunting. And I hear so many people, oh, I can't do watercolor. That just isn't possible. But it is a part of learning that it's back to what we were talking about in a different way, actual flow. It is allowing that medium to also create. And that's the interesting thing. So the paper, how much water I use, where I put pigment, how much pigment it is versus how watery it is, all of that is allowing also another artist to come involved. And that's the canvas and the medium itself has to interact. Mm-hmm. And that's why people, I think, get frustrated, because they don't feel that they control it. But on another way, it's great because you don't have control.
I agree so much. And I always tell students, because I have so many people interested and do a lot of one-on-one classes in my studio and with you, the Zoom classes. And I always tell them, you don't have to do much to make this beautiful. Watercolor in itself will be beautiful. And so if you, in watercolor, it takes just as much restraint as it does to add on to the piece. And that is part of the challenge, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. And not feeling that you have to cover the paper or the canvas entirely with the water. That is the really, I think people that do it don't realize, if you look at a lot of really great watercolors, there's more white on there or whatever it is, cream or, you know, whatever the background color is.
Yeah, wow. I think another big challenge for people is that there's no eraser, you know, with other forms.
Right, I can't get it off there. I've tried. And the paper, but the paper deteriorates if you really try, work too hard.
Right, so, yep.
You got to turn it into something that's there. This is really great. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further with your family or in conversation with others, any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with our guest, Megan Jefferson, about the way she has been using watercolors to help us relax and to help herself relax, the way that watercolors kind of also help to create themselves. And I think, Megan, in that whole world of thinking about that, now that I think about it, you hear it all over and over again. Let's say it's something and somebody does pottery and throws it on a wheel. The most frustrating thing for beginners is they have to flow with the clay. They can't fight it. And if they try to fight it and control it, they destroy it. These are really great lessons that I think artists learn, which gives a lot of artists a different perspective on the world. Because you have to learn, right, as an artist, that you're not the only thing controlling all this. There's just a lot of other stuff that's out of your control.
100% agree. There's nothing that will end in disaster more than if you kind of have a plan and then there's an inflexibility in sticking with it. So I think that the magic and the creativity come in those pockets of opportunity or problem solving. And it definitely feels like more of a dance when you allow yourself that space.
Yeah, I know so many artists, and I know artists that are wanting to learn as well, or people that are becoming artists. There is this, sometimes I've lost it as an artist, and sometimes they don't know how to get it. What are some recommendations you have for how somebody can get outside of that idea of having to control what they're creating and get into a flow of creating? Then there's a difference between those two. How do you encourage somebody to do something?
Well, I think that the first step is to create a creative practice. There's nothing that is better for actually learning a material than just doing it, you know? And so I think that a lot of people feel like they have to have a lot of background knowledge before they actually start creating. And the act of creating itself is just going to lead to the discovery of new ways of, you know, creating things with that material. So whether it be, you know, if you're a structured person and you want to take the time to set aside a certain time in your day to devote to your creative practice, or if you feel like, you know, there can be less restrictions and just a time when you feel inspired to create, that might work for you too. But I think also doing things that inspire you and then help to get into that creative space where you can be a little more flexible is super helpful. So for me, looking at art and being inspired by art is one of the things that I do if I feel stuck. So I might go to an art museum or a sculpture park or even visit somebody's art class. That is always one of the things that lights a fire within me. And so I think that's super encouraging and helpful to people if they feel like they just can't get to a place where they feel inspired to create. Movement is also something that I found that helps me get into a creative space. So putting on my favorite music and dancing, that's one of my most favorite things to do, is start by dancing and moving in my studio. And I also stand up when I paint, especially if I'm painting with oils. And so I'll stand in front of my easel and just let the movement sort of guide me to a place where I can start making marks on the canvas. And so it's a little less daunting for people who have that blank canvas trepidation. But for me, just putting anything on the canvas and getting something down is a great way to start the process. And then not feeling like every piece has to be a masterpiece. Right. So knowing that you can always paint over something, knowing that you can always start over, knowing that you can start another piece, that's just how art is. You don't have to feel contained by the fact that, you know, you spent this money on these materials and now it has to be exactly what you want it to be. So whatever gets you in a place of freedom, I think is also a good place to start when developing your creative practice.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is there are individuals who may have started out life being where their way of being feeling comfortable is to have a lot of control. They want to control everything around them. There are also people who have become that, mm-hmm. you know, through life experience. And when you're going to go into the creative part of art and not be a technician, then there's a difference here. We can also be a technician just like in science and just do something. But when we're talking about that, you have to take a risk. And it may be just a little step, but what you're saying is you're encouraging people to, okay, just step out there just a little bit. Not so far that you're going to fall off the cliff, but out there just enough that you can see over the edge. And so, if they can do that, they can capture that. And they really need that in their art. And I see so many people struggling, even as professional artists, who just get stuck because they can't get out of there. They can't get out of that and into that risk that mm-hmm. it might not work. Mm-hmm. And when I would assume when you're doing any of it, you have confidence in your skills and your talents, but it also you're going in it with some risk. It might not work. It might not come out the way I like it. It may not come out where people love it. It just might happen.
Yeah, there's a lot tied up in creating work and then showing people your work, or, you know, just getting started. And it takes a lot of courage. And the more you do it, the easier it becomes, just like anything. And the more support we have around us to do it, I think is helpful as well. So for me, having a family that's creative, a husband that's creative and super supportive, people that I can collaborate with is also really nice. Just watching other people work is something that I really love too, because I have learned so much just by watching other artists' creative process and learning that it's okay if something doesn't go in a direction that they were planning, and the ease at with which they let that change. Early on my career, you know, I faced a lot of those same, I think, hurdles. And that was one of the things that helped me the most. And having a creative community around me where I could get feedback maybe before presenting to a larger group always is nice as well. And the act of creating is so therapeutic. I see it all the time when working with students that it oftentimes doesn't even matter what they actually make, because during the process of making, they have had these breakthroughs, these emotional breakthroughs, or kind of, you know, visited all kinds of memories that they hadn't thought about in a while, or whatever it is. It's a therapeutic process that we all have access to, and it just does take a little courage to explore.
Yeah, and I see you, and when I work closely with you through the classes we do together, and I see you all the time doing that encouragement and support, and whatever they produce, we're celebrating the fact that they produce something.
Yeah,
and it isn't important, you know, whether they're going to be able to sell it to somebody for a lot of money or do that. So I think you're right in that. The other thing that comes to mind is that you really are, and I watch you doing this, but you really are a lifelong learner. And so you just keep wanting to learn something different. I remember in one class was the first time you found metallic paints and you started to want to use them in metallic watercolors. And you started to use them expressively in your work, and you were so enthusiastic and excited about it. Almost like a child got a special gift. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think that curiosity has always been something that I've never been afraid of. And so I'm not one of those people that is afraid to ask a question or explore something new. And with art, there's never-ending opportunities for that.
Yeah, I think the last thing that I want to talk to you about briefly is just this idea that you can be expressive. You can go ahead and go out there and take that little bit of risk and do it. And you can do it in the privacy yourself too. And that can start a mechanism going in your brain that really transcends over to the rest of your life. And so what I see in you is a lot of your life is also grounded. And I think people think of artists as always being, you know, they give them bad names, you know, artsy fartsy. They give them all these terrible names. Mm-hmm. But I think the really good artists that I know are grounded. They're, mm-hmm. they're really solid in what they do, the self-confidence they have, the self-efficacy they have. And I see that in you as well.
Thank you. I don't know if there's another way to be that would feel right. You know, and I think that part of finding a creative practice that makes me feel so whole is now the meter with which I judge everything in my life. So without my creative practice, I don't necessarily feel like myself.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I've been talking with our guest, Megan Jefferson, and I encourage you at home to go out there and just go to the store and get just a little watercolor set, or get some markers or whatever, or color pencils, and just start this exploration. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com. DaVinciPursuit.com.